there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Thunderpants!
What are you laughing at?
Laffy Taffy. They have a funny joke on every wrapper, and I love how fruity they are. Banana's my favorite. Want one?
Sure. Mmm, so smooth and creamy.
I like to eat them after school and after dinner and after...
Whenever you need a good LOL?
Yeah! So, here's the joke. What do clouds wear under their shorts?
Thunderpants. That is good.
Laffy Taffy. Deliciously funny. Head to LaffyTaffy.com to shop now.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Lipke. With me is Alex Bowden.
Hello.
We are covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is more ridiculous at cricket, England or Australia. And we are just about to wrap up the 2013 Ashes.
Yes, fifth test of the series, so we don't really need to explain this too much. But basically, we pick out the most ridiculous moments from each test match, go through them and pick out our favourites. Dan nominates for Australia, I nominate for England, and we award points to the most ridiculous moments. 3-2-1 points for the top three. The series is 1-1 after a drawn fourth test.
All to play for.
Yes, so this is the clincher. Ian Bell's series-long heroics weren't quite enough to carry the day over Australia's one-hour collapse and Chris Rogers and Shane Watson's non-opening partnership in the fourth test, so that was a draw.
Yes.
And now, yeah, 1-1, all to play for. So yes. What actually happened in the fifth test, Dan?
Yes, well, Australia won the toss and they elected to frolic their way to 492 for 9 declared. Shane Watson scored his highest test score, 176. Steve Smith made his first century in international cricket. He finished on 138 not out. And in reply, only one England batter got past 50. They did manage, despite that, to reach 377 all out. But they did so on the fifth day because there was a rained out fourth day, which seemed certain to doom the match to a draw. But Australia did thrash their way to 111 for 6 declared. And that declaration came at tea on the final day, which meant England had either one session to score 227 for a win or collapse and be bowled out for a loss, or as it turned out, get within 20 runs of victory with 4 overs and 5 wickets remaining when bad light terminated play. The match was therefore a draw. England had to settle for a mere 3-0 Ashes win.
Yes, it was a draw in actual terms, but in ridiculous terms we're going to decide the result now.
Yes.
My first nomination certainly makes sense first because it's selectorial one. This match is probably, like, in England, best remembered as being Simon Kerrigan's test match. I was going to say his debut, but I think the odds of him playing a second test are not high.
Yes.
He's playing okay, but I think his time has gone.
Well, and when you say Simon Kerrigan's test, you don't mean, like, Botham's test or Flintoff's test or Stokes' test.
No, not in that respect. Just his experience within the test, I suppose, is a better way of putting it.
Yes.
England's team selection for this match was pretty odd. Experimental, really, with them 3-0 off, and it does feel a bit like they were getting ahead of themselves. We can only really guess at the reasoning, but the circumstances were that I think Tim Bresnan was injured, so he needed replacing. But at some point during these conversations, they also decided to drop Johnny Bairstow, which I don't know if that came first or whether it was a consequence of who they picked to replace Bresnan or what. But fundamentally, they had a choice between, I think, Chris Tremlett, who couldn't bat, or Chris Wokes, who could, to replace Tim Bresnan, and they went with Chris Wokes. And it was Chris Wokes' debut as well, it should be mentioned.
Yes.
So he was a bit of an unknown quantity at test level. And as is always the case with any English seam bowler who has made a first-class 100, they thought, oh, maybe he could be the new Ian Botham. So they almost like reflexively put him into bat at number 6, at which point Yeah, Bairstow was out. I don't know what order those things happened, but that was the long and short of it. So it was Wokes at 6 and then Matt Pryor at 7, which it does not make sense with Hindsight Corner.
Hindsight Corner.
I don't know, maybe it didn't really make sense at the time either.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's see if he can be our all-rounder. And at this point, they can then pick another bowler, and they presumably thought, we've got enough seam bowlers, it's the oval, it's the end, we need another spinner. Monty Panesar had almost literally pissed away his chances of playing a second spinner with our whole nightclub thing that we covered earlier in the series, where he got above the nightclub and urinated on a bouncer and got in a little bit of trouble with that. Next cab off the rank, as they say, was Lancashire Simon Kerrigan. England's spin bowling stocks are never like hugely deep. He was bowling really well in first class cricket, but yeah, he was definitely sort of third choice spinner really in terms of ability. He played against Australia for England Lions the week before, and Shane Watson had rather hammered him. Nevertheless, he was picked for the fifth test, and Shane Watson rather hammered him again.
Yeah.
And that's really the story of his test match. Simon Kerrigan came on to bowl. His first two overs went for 28. Watching it on the highlights, it feels like about 45 minutes worth of play, because your perception of time is different. So if you see sort of this many boundaries, you think, well, that must have been like half the afternoon session. Yep. But it was literally just, they were showing every single ball of Simon Kerrigan's over, because obviously it was his first ball in test cricket, and then there was a lot of fours and sixes, and then they reached a point where a dot ball was almost newsworthy. They would kind of show that as well. He eventually finished with none for 53 off 8 overs, and then he didn't get to bowl in the second inning. It was not great bowling.
Yeah, so I went back to Twitter, and my thoughts at the time were this tweet. I am told that Kerrigan is a much better bowler than we've seen in this test so far, and I'm pleased for him, because imagine if he wasn't.
that's entirely fair. So as I say, he's never played for England since, and almost certainly never will. But I mean, as a counterpoint to this, while everyone remembers his bowling in this match, no one remembers his batting. One not out in his only test innings.
Yep.
So he never took a wicket in international cricket, but he was never dismissed either.
Never involved in a wicket in any way.
And I suppose the other great contribution he made really was that it was a nice distraction for Chris Wokes, who had a pretty ordinary test match really on his debut, but it was the kind of thing, it was pretty easily overlooked with Kerrigan sort of lobbing up full tosses and long hops.
Well, I think that probably segues neatly to my first nomination. My first nomination is Figure of Fun Tons, or a.k.a. Watto and Smith Centuries. So as we mentioned, Watto was mostly a figure of fun at this point in his career. Everybody was like, oh God, he's going to review again.
During this series, it's probably reached up the climax really.
Yes. But this test, he was not a figure of fun. This was almost certainly the best I've seen him bat. He came in at 3 to join Chris Rogers again, which was another new batting position for Watto. He'd been up and down the order a few times.
A pretty good one, because he made 176. So.
Yeah, as you mentioned, he was absolutely having none of Kerrigan. He just brutalised him. He savage pulls, drives, everything. He was just absolutely merciless on poor old Kerrigan, who, as you mentioned, he had an early cider of in the match the week before, and quite liked the look of him.
Yeah.
And pretty much the only way to get rid of him was an excellent catch in the deep, which had... And I really like this. It was Stuart Broad bowling, and in the process, almost bowling a no ball. They had to go back and check the front foot on that one. We also had Kevin Peterson taking a very good catch, but also, because he's KP, putting a little bit of flair on the dive at the end. And that was all to dismiss Shane Watson. And I can't really think of a better trio of ridiculous cricketers to be involved in a wicket. That's like chef's kiss stuff.
Yeah, certainly from this era. That's your sort of podium of ridiculousness.
Yes. So when he was finally out, as we mentioned, he had scored 176. Australia, as a team, had only scored 289, which meant that Watto had scored 60.9% of the runs in the innings to that point, which is not quite Bannerman territory, but it's not that far away either. He'd been absolutely dominating the entire innings.
Yeah, it's not like 60% of like 90 runs.
Yes.
They have 289. We're sort of well into the match. But one thing I liked about it was when he was out, it's just very, very Shane Watson. He just looks so incredibly puppy dog sad about being dismissed.
Yes.
It was just absolute brutal destruction for hours on end, this gigantic orc of a man. And yet somehow Watto still ends up looking like the victim at the end of it, which is, I think, his calling card, really.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I feel like Cameron Green's picked up that mantle now. Cameron Green's this big colossus of a young lad, and he likes to give it a bit of a thump. And when he's out, he always looks so desperately sad as well. Or when someone hits him for a six, he also looks sad. He's wears his heart on his sleeve, much like Watto always did.
Yeah, there's batters who are furious to be out, and there's batters who are like almost in tears to be out. Watto is definitely an almost in tears to be out. Batter.
Yes. Well, one of the ones who, as we've learned, a little bit of hindsight corner here, tends to be more in the furious camp when he's out, is the only bigger figure of fun in the Australian team at the time, which was Stephen Smith, who, as we discussed right back at the beginning of this series, was mostly in the team to crack jokes and keep the dressing room a happy place. So no one was taking him seriously. And pretty much until this innings, where he made 130 not out, as we mentioned, it was his first Test 100. And he batted pretty much like what we now know as pure Smith. We did get a couple of glimpses of that earlier in the series, but nothing quite to the extent of this one. This was just sustained Smithness. It began pretty much, you know, right at the start of his innings. He was on one and he advanced down the pitch to Swan and just lofted him for six pretty much effortlessly. And Jeff Boycott on commentary declared it to be risky. Didn't slow Smith down much.
I think that's just a reflex from Jeff whenever the ball is not on the ground, contact with grass.
Yes. Yes. So that wasn't the only six. He also brought up his century with a lofted six off the bowling of Jonathan Trott, which perhaps shows how desperate England were getting at that point. And then, you know, by that stage, Australia started looking for some declaration runs. And he came up with this shot where he somehow swatted a bouncer from outside his off stump at about shoulder height. And he managed to somehow get it to the deep mid-wicket boundary, which, you know, by itself might have been worthy of a ridiculous nomination.
If it's the shot I'm thinking of, it's the one where he played it front on.
Yes.
Basically, his front leg. He basically, for reasons which don't entirely make sense, what we've given where the ball was going, his front foot just sort of launches towards deep square leg, and he's in this huge sort of wide-legged front-on position, and he just sort of pans it.
Yeah. So I'm going to indulge in quite a lot of hindsight corner here now, because this really was the start of the Steve Smith legend period, basically. He averaged 29.52 coming to this test. It took him eight further tests and three centuries to boost his average beyond 40. Obviously, this test got him beyond 30.
Yeah.
Then five more tests after that to boost his average beyond 50. So in 13 tests, he'd gone from an average of 29 to beyond 50. Although, to be fair, it took him ages to get his average beyond 60. So... kind of look at it another way. His first 11 tests, he averaged 29.52. This was the start of his second set of 11 tests, during which he averaged 53.82. And then in his third set of 11 tests, he averaged 91.76. So lots of hindsight corner there, but probably nobody at the time really believed, based on this one innings, that he would transform into this kind of insatiable run-scoring monster. But it was definitely kind of a glimpse of something that we did not expect from Steve Smith. Whatever jokes we'd all made previously seemed suddenly on very shaky ground.
I like this mechanic of breaking a player's career down into 11s, into batches of 11. Is that a thing we should do?
Yes. Strange to take 11 tests to decide you're going to sort yourself out and then sort yourself out so rapidly.
Right. Well, I'm gonna move into a fairly familiar one, really. I've basically nominated it before in a previous test match. That's Alistair Cook's unfunky captaincy.
Yeah.
I always say unfunky because it's in sort of marked contrast to Michael Clarke. Shane Warne who described it?
I think, yeah, Shane Warne did like to use the term funky captaincy quite a lot.
Yeah, so that became a sort of cliche about Michael Clarke. And the two of them set against each other. It shows Alistair Cook's way of working all the clearer, I think. So like I said, this is a close cousin of my third test nomination of Cook's use of part-time bowlers. He's reluctant to use them, really. And again, in this test, his bowler favouritism is just equally apparent. In that third test, in Australia's first inning, Alistair Cook had used his four frontline bowlers for 141 out of 146 overs. So
yep.
clearly, when things aren't going that well, trying something different is not to Alistair Cook's taste. Just persevere with plan A.
Yeah,
it's plan A for a reason. Why would you ever resort to plan B? Plan A was the best one. That's the best plan.
Plan B, by definition, is an inferior plan. Yes.
So in this test, he had 5 frontline bowlers at his disposal, and he used 4 of them for 118 overs out of 129 in Australia's first innings. I mean, obviously, that was greatly influenced by Simon Kerrigan's first 2 overs in particular. But still, he's not making up that shortfall anywhere else. The remaining 3 were bowled by Jonathan Trott, as you pointed out, who bowled Brad Haddin with a pretty filthy wide one off the inside edge.
Yes, 8 feels like generous for Kerrigan, given what we knew. I think flip them around, give Kerrigan 3 and maybe Trott 8.
Yeah, it's the kind of pot, like dibbly dobbly part-time medium pace of it. He's got the look. He's not tall enough to be bowling. That's another thing that Quaff and part-time bowlers are a bit bold. He's a bit short. He just doesn't look like he should be bowling. And of course, it's going to be dibbly dobbly medium pace. What else would it be?
Yeah, I always forget that Trott occasionally bowls. So it was quite startling to see him coming in and bowling. I looked at him and thought, who the hell is this bowling? Because there's just this little bald man running in. And I was just like, what's going on here? So yeah, always very startling to see him have a spell. It's the same kind of vibe I get whenever I saw, Ricky Ponting or Damien Martin bowl some medium pace. And it's just like, what's going on here?
Ponting's a really, really similar bowler, different sort of vibe. So that was the first innings. And then in the second innings, with Australia pushing for a declaration, Alistair Cook paired things back a bit further. The innings was admittedly only 23 overs long, but he only used 3 bowlers for that.
Yeah,
and he was back to his absolute favourites. Anson, Broad and Swan. If he could have just rotated those for the rest of his captaincy career, he'd have been happy.
Yes, I believe if there were 6 tests, he probably might have just gone Anderson and Broad for 180 overs.
Plan A. There are opening bowlers for a reason. Why would we use anybody else?
Yeah.
And then, but there's another aspect to this, which is, of course, batting. You're not as influential as a captain, but chasing 227 in 44 overs, you got potential to do something that, went with exactly the same batting order as the first innings. You've got to admire how incredibly inflexible Alistair Cook was.
Yes. I've often made jokes that work on the basis that Alistair Cook was some kind of robot cricketer, and this kind of stuff is exactly why. It's just just a magnificent automaton of a cricketer. Just, I'll turn out the runs, I'll turn out the captaincy with the same kind of methodical approach. Okay, so my next nomination is kind of semi-related to your first one, because this was also James Faulkner's test debut and also James Faulkner's sole test. So he was given his first and probably, much like Kerrigan, only test cap. Ashton Agar had been sent home because he was sick, apparently, presumably sick of not being selected for Australia.
Hey!
So Faulkner came into the side and he got figures of 4 for 51 in the first innings, which seemed pretty good, right?
Yeah. I mean, those are really tidy figures. A couple of against second, quick runs. It just seems a really solid test match for someone who only played one test. Like, how do you take 4 for 51 and then... bye. Like, that's it.
Yeah, it was very strange. The wickets kind of, they started off kind of spectacularly. The first one was this diving one-handed catch down the leg side to get rid of Ian Bell, the summer of Bell, the ultra nemesis. And then there was another diving catch, this time from Mitchell Stark, who raced around from mid-on, and he got rid of a skied shot from Pryor. So it was all very spectacular to begin with.
Yeah, and that sort of dive of Stark's, he nearly ended up in the sand.
Yes.
Which is a thing I've never seen happen on a cricket field.
Yeah,
I would very much like to see.
Yeah. Anyway, I got a bit boring after that. A regulation caught behind, and then he bowled Swan to end the innings. He got two wickets in the second inning, so 6 wickets for the match. And he also had 2 good declaration batting innings. Both times he came in, Australia were looking for quick runs. He got 23 off 21 and 22 off 22, both perfectly acceptable, I would have thought.
I mean, like, particularly in contrast to like Simon Kerrigan, the two of them, both the same outcome ultimately, but yet very different contributions to this particular task.
Yeah, I'm not sure Faulkner's too happy at being lumped in with Simon Kerrigan. It's a bit sad for him.
Okay, I'll move into my next one, which is, it's the final one. England not really going for the win until the evening of day 5, which is, there's hindsight corner here, but looking at the match as a whole, it was weird the way England went about things. They just never really seemed interested until after tea on day 5, which in terms of like a sporting fixture as a Like, you know, a football match is long since over after that volume of play, but England just never really sort of pondering much until then.
Yeah, leaving it to the last 6% of the match is a wild tactic.
Yeah, I mean, so just to sort of give, like, how it panned out, at lunch on day one, Australia were 112-1 and England were already on the back foot.
Yeah.
So they were sort of not, I don't know, I mean, obviously they're going for the win in the sense that they're playing a cricket, competitive cricket match, but it's towards the back of the mind and there's the sort of conviction is not really there. They then batted with just incredible lack of intent. All of the top six made at least 25. We're saying it was this innings where it was 150 and it was quite sizable. It's one of those weird innings where you're not quite sure how it adds up to to the total. But all of the top six made at least 25, but their strike rates were all in the 20s and 30s. It was just drifting non-event of an inning. There was one passage of play where Ian Bell made 5 runs in 45 balls. It must have been
God.
I presumably I was watching it. I don't know. It's kind of faded from memory.
I may have gone to bed early on those days, I think.
Yeah, definitely one to be in the opposite hemisphere.
Yes.
When day five began, they were 274 for 4 in their first inning in 116 overs. So we've reached this point in the match. England, you're not even halfway through their first innings. That's how committed to victory they are.
And I do seem to recall that Shane Warne was absolutely furious about this, as you'd expect. This is where he started his kind of catchphrase of, yeah, you need to be willing to lose to win. And he was very upset that England didn't seem to be willing to lose the match by trying to score more quickly than this. And we'll get to the counterpoint to that shortly. But he was very annoyed with England for batting so slowly. And Alastair Cook in particular for not, you know, telling his team to hurry on with it.
Yeah, I mean, a sort of passive, reactive captain, really. I was just waiting for circumstance to come round in his favour. And then, lo and behold, tea on day five is a declaration, and they're asked to make 200-something in 40 overs. At which point, they had a proper tilt at it. They just thought, all right, we can win this match, and just switched on. They'd just been kind of playing post till then.
Yeah, very cunning, very sneaky. No, I don't kind of associate this kind of sneakiness with England. It seems a little bit against the spirit of cricket to me, to play dead for most of the test. Yes. All right. Well, that leads me nicely into my final nomination, which is, of course, Michael Clarke's second innings declaration.
Yes, I suspected as much. I kind of preempted you a bit there, but let's get to it.
Yeah, so basically this was always looming, because from very early on in this test, Australia must have seen the weather forecast and seen that it was awful, because they were declaration batting on day two with some violent cameos from Faulkner, as we mentioned, and also Stark and Harris just coming out and having a thrash. And on the evening of the second day after the first innings declaration, Root and Cook were offered the light. And Australia weren't particularly impressed by this. Clarke came up and he was like, what's going on? Why are you offering them the light? And, you know, unsurprisingly, the umpires' minds weren't changed. They almost never are. And the only reason I'm mentioning this is because this is just a brilliant piece of setup for how the test ends. I have a theory that with all this foreshadowing, that's what caused the light to be so poor, all the shadows.
The weather just interpreted the narrative.
Yes.
And acted accordingly.
Yes. But the first innings declaration wasn't really the interesting one. The second innings was the interesting one. Perhaps riled up by all this Shane Warne lose to win speak, he decided that he sent the team out, 111 for 6 declared in 23 overs. It began half an hour into the afternoon session of the final day. Chris Rogers was not to be seen. He was just demoted all the way down to the tail, because the batting lineup in that second innings was Warner and Watto to open. James Faulkner came in at 3, then Brad Haddin, then Clarke himself. Smith came in after that, then Harris and Stark, and poor old Rogers was left with Siddle and Lyon as the ones that didn't get a bat. Just a wonderfully silly batting lineup for that second innings.
It's not quite names out of a hat, is it? But it's you don't you really don't know who's coming next. Australia, that was another theme of this. Is Australia hardly ever had the same batting lineup 2 innings in a row. I checked this.
Yep.
Obviously, they tended to change team after each test.
Yes.
So you're never going to get like the same batting lineup second innings one test and first the next. But they generally changed batting order during tests as well. It was only the second and the fourth where they had the same batting order twice in a row.
Yeah, and they were the two tests in which they performed the worst. In the tests where they mucked about with the batting orders, they lost by 14 runs in the first test, and then they dominated a couple of rainy draws. So clearly, Michael Clarke should have been mixing up the batting order, you know, more often.
Yeah, Vindicator. vindication.
Yes. Anyway, after all this mad thrashing about, he decided that he was willing to lose to win because he went over and knocked on the door of Alastair Cook at tea and set England 227 in 44 overs. So that's one session to bowl England out, which, you know, it's funky captaincy, but it's a very optimistic funky captaincy, right? England had both KP batting and Ian Bell in summer of Bell form. So those two were at, you know, grave risk of running down 227 in 44 overs all by themselves. There were plenty
of others. Well, not on first innings form. On first innings form, it would have taken them the best part of 3 days to start. I don't know if he was if that factored into his calculations.
Yeah. Anyway, so as you said, England decided all of a sudden, despite sticking with the same batting order, let's not change plan A. We'll stick with this. They ended up needing 21 off 24 balls when Chekhov's light meter from back on day two returned at the climax of the match, and the umpire said, "Nah, light's no good. We'll have to go off." And everyone was perfectly happy with that. Fair's fair. Right?
Absolutely. One of my favourite parts of this is Matt Prior arguing that he can see perfectly well based on zero balls that he's faced at this point in the match, because he'd just been a wicket. He'd come out, he'd not faced anything at all. Then he'd say, "No, I can see perfectly well." "How do you know, Matt? You've not been there."
Yeah. I think Alim Dar was pressured by Michael Clarke to get the light meter out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then he's pushing him back with this light meter, which is one of those sort of like head-to-heads you see. I don't know, like when there's a really bad decision and the modern cricketers getting really irate about it, of like hassle the umpire. It's more kind of a football thing, but like it's such a wonderful cricket situation to be hassling somebody to check the light with your light meter. So as all this is going on, Michael Vaughan on commentary, I was listening to him on the highlights, and he says he'd have stayed out there if he was Clark, you know, like proper like lose to win.
Yeah, I do like the idea that perhaps Alim Dar was pushing Michael Clark out of the road because Clark was, you know, the shadow of Clark was upsetting the light meter.
Conceivably.
Yes. And basically, a little bit of hindsight corner here. This was very similar to the 2022 Women's Ashes. Meg Lanning did a similarly generous declaration. Not quite as generous, but there was also rain ruining a good chunk of the penultimate day in that one. And she set England 257 off 48 overs. And England were mostly cruising in that match. But this one didn't have bad light intervening to stop play. Instead, the match played out to its conclusion, which was, you know, this thrilling draw, 9 wickets down and 12 runs short of victory. So there were far fewer fans booing the umpires at the end of that match.
Maybe this one would have ended exactly the same, 9 wickets down, 12. That would have been an exciting finish if it got to that.
Yes.
Maybe that's what Michael Vaughan was arguing for with his visions of the future.
Yeah, could have still had a chance to win this. Why is Michael Clarke so cowardly? Not thinking he takes 6 more wickets in these last 4 overs.
It's easy to commentate and like claim these things. It just seemed like they only needed 20 odd runs and they had loads of wickets left. Like, no, you wouldn't. You wouldn't in a million years be arguing to stay out there. Like, are you kidding?
So that's my final nomination.
Okay. Unnominated moments, then, have you got any?
Yeah, I've got a pretty good one, which I was trying to squeeze in there, but I couldn't work out a way. I basically squeezed Watto and Smith into one nomination. I couldn't work out how to get Mitchell Stark's dismissal of Bell in here, but it was really good. Bell did a drive and Mitchell Stark stuck his big boot out and stopped it in the follow-through, then kind of picked it up and spun around and hit the stumps with the throw back, and poor old Ian Bell was trying to retreat back to his ground and couldn't get there. And I one of the things I like most about this, beside the fact it was, you know, ridiculously good piece of fielding, was Mitchell Stark was furious about the whole thing. He gave a hearty fuck off to Ian Bell, which again, hindsight corner, it's very out of character. He's mostly pretty smiling and pleasant most of the time. Like most fast bowlers have the occasional bad mood, but for the most part, Mitchell Stark's generally pretty upbeat. It's very possible that he'd been listening to Shane Warne, who was no doubt telling him he needed to show more intent.
It was a new piece of fielding. I was just sort of like replaying it in my mind's eye. Then he sort of stops it with his right boot.
Yeah.
But it ends up sort of like popping. The ball pops up in the air, but slightly backwards. So he almost like shields the ball from the batter's view, I think from Ian Bell's view. So he doesn't know what's going on. Bell's sort of like belting down the ground, thinking it's gone past him. But actually, it's just chipped up nicely for him to grab. And because he's left-handed, he just carries on turning. And then he just sort of appreciates the situation opened up before him. Like Ian Bell's alongside him. stumps. Like, he's got a ball in his hand looking at the stumps square on, and he just sort of throws them down, not as an afterthought, but just kind of like, I don't know. It's a very strange, like, sort of vibe to it. It was a great wicket. Another wicket that I enjoyed was Peter Siddle getting bowled, which it's a weird one. It's partly just that highlights are not sort of like massive HD, like crystal clear, but it looks and sounds like he middles Anderson 4. Like the shot he plays and where the ball is, but the ball actually seems away. But actually, he's clean bowled and it just sounds like ball on bat because it's sort of like hit the timber so hard.
Yes.
Well, my other one is just, it was actually before this test. It was before this test that Darren Lehman was fined for saying Broad not walking was blatant cheating. And he hoped that Australians would really give him shit in the return series.
Yeah.
It's just important to remember that was part of the backdrop. It's kind of just kind of like throwing back to the Broad not walking from the first test.
Yes.
This was like a ripple of that before the next series when we have another wave of Broad not walking stuff.
All right, how are we going to vote for this one? I'm going to put up Michael Clarke's declaration as possibly one of the more ridiculous declarations that has ever been seen on a cricket field.
Yeah, because it is an Ashes test and it is generous. I mean, he's partly just like fallen in love with his own reputation.
Yes.
There, I think. But he's gone ahead and done it anyway. That was pretty ridiculous. And the way it played out as well.
Yeah, I also like the footage that they've got. They've got the footage of him like in the tea break, just trotting down from the Australian dressing room and over to the other one. And he does this little knock on the door and pokes his head in and says, here you go, guys. And I think England are like, holy shit, really?
Yeah, you don't normally see a declaration. Mm. Well, you do when they call the batters in, but like in a tea break, because of the way that the ground is laid out, that you actually see him like toddle across and quick knock on the door. It's like, well, don't answer. Well,
and kind of everything around it, like the crazy change of the batting order to get these runs and just trying to manufacture, you know, a win out of what should have been a draw for no clear reason, but he went ahead and did it anyway. Very ridiculous, Michael Clarke. I love it.
That is a really good one. And I'm going to sort of whittle away one of mine because I think England not really going for the win to late on is just totally hinges on this happening. Like it couldn't happen otherwise. So let's strike that one from eligibility. So I've got Simon Kerrigan's bonkers debut and Alistair Cook's unfunky captaincy again, which... I don't know, again, like, it's almost like the yin and yang of Cook and Clark. They both highlight each other's ridiculousness through their own actions or inactions, in Alistair Cook's case.
Yeah, they definitely, the contrast between them helps make both of them seem more exaggerated comical figures, which is very neat.
So what do you make of Simon Kerrigan's debut?
I mean, it is very ridiculous to be selected for one test, bowl... What did he bowl? First two overs for 28 runs.
28, That was basically it.
I mean, it's a very ridiculous test match for the poor guy. You can't completely blame Cook for not giving him another go, although maybe he could have. I guess Australia were like sprinting along so rapidly that, you know, if Cook was even thinking about, you know, trying to prevent, you know, Australia from declaring too quickly, he wasn't game to put Kerrigan back on.
Well, we are arguing that diminishes Alistair Cook's unfunky captaincy there, don't we? It doesn't really add any funk to it, but it makes it a bit less meat and potatoes than it might otherwise be. It's a bit more comprehensible.
Mm.
Okay, well, let's relegate that a little bit. I attempted to go for Michael Clarke's second innings declaration.
I think that's kind of the crux of the test. Simon Kerrigan's good. I think Clark's declaration is just crazy stuff. It makes the entire test to my mind, because you've got this kind of panic, like, and the way it just blows up in his face, where, you know, without the intervention of the light meters, and that's another the perfect thing, him being so furious about them on day two and then them coming to his rescue on day five. It's everything about it is delicious. I love it so much.
So let's go for 3 points for Michael Clarke then.
Yeah.
Are we giving two to Simon Kerrigan?
I think so. I mean, that's a very silly debut and final test for Simon Kerrigan. So I think that's probably the strongest one. I'd like to put in an argument for Watto and Smith's centuries. I know there's a lot of hindsight corner in the Smith one, but Watto this was ridiculously good batting from Watto, which I guess is helped by Simon Kerrigan. So we're again.
Well, know, yeah, blend. But I was going to argue the opposite, really, that it is an interaction between two players. And Simon Kerrigan has come on to bowl to the guy who had hammered him in the previous match, or, you know, semi-hammered him in the previous match. And that, I think, will have had a huge impact on how he felt going to bowl. And then when Shane Watson immediately started playing as he feared, as Simon Kerrigan no doubt feared that he would, that would have just that basically just unraveled everything from the outset for him. And I think we always talk about our definition of ridiculous being good, like it's more often than not it's terrible cricket. Sometimes it's nonsense cricket, but it can be good cricket as well. And I think the way Shane Watson batted, I think, had such an influence on that that passage of play.
Yeah,
maybe even, I mean, to be honest, if he's getting a point and Michael Clarke's getting 3 points, then Australia have got the test anyway. But I'd almost be tempted to shunt Watto. I mean, Steve Smith in there as a sort of supporting role in the partnership. Yeah, yeah, maybe even 3 points, 2 points to Australia, and just a point for poor Simon Kerrigan.
Well, I'm not going to argue with that.
One point to watch his one not out and his one test match.
All right, I think that's perfect. Let's go that for that then. So I think that means Australia do win the fifth test, which means they claim the 2013 ridiculous Ashes.
Curses!
I can't remember who won the 2013-14, but I strongly suspect it was England. So Australia won't be holding the ridiculous Ashes for too long here.
No, it's not with Ashes coming thick and fast in this era, every few months.
Congratulations to Australia, and congratulations to you for listening to this 2013 ridiculous Ashes, and thank you as well. And also special thanks to Pat Cummins for dropping by in the first test way back all those weeks ago.
Yeah, cheers, Pat.
And thank you to Leah Schneider for providing us with DVD footage of this test series. And we'll be back a bit later. We don't quite know yet what our next series will be, so probably best to just subscribe to the podcast to find out. And of course, while you're doing that, give us your honest 5-star ratings. And I think we've got a policy that the sooner we get to 100 5-star ratings and reviews, the sooner we'll record our next series.
Yes, that's official policy. Yes.
Until then, you can check out Alex's website. That's kingcricket.co.uk. Mine is leebcricket.com. You can follow us on Twitter at ridiculousashes, at the King's Tweets, and at leebcricket. And if you enjoyed this episode and want to support us with actual living money, Alex is at patreon.com/kingcricket. I'm at patreon.com/leebcricket. Give us both some money, and we will see you next time. Bye.
To Lee.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.